is Halloween. This is Halloween. Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
And this is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau. In celebration of Halloween, we're talking about the history of the holiday and a paranormal study. Our guest today is Lisa Morton. She's a screenwriter and author of nonfiction and prose. She earned the Bram Stoker Award, given in honor to Rice writers. And more importantly today, an expert in all things Halloween and paranormal. Wondering about the story behind a certain Halloween tradition? We'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. I assume you like to talk about Halloween.
Yes, fortunately, because I do a lot of it right now.
Yeah, I'll bet you're super busy these days. Well, we were really thrilled that you could join us. What fascinates you about Halloween and its history?
Well, it's an interesting holiday for a couple of reasons. It is very misunderstood. I think of it as the most misunderstood of all of our holidays. And it also is a holiday that is constantly changing and in transition and has been very different throughout the centuries. I think someone from 200 years ago probably would have no idea what was going on if they looked at our modern Halloween.
And it's not just people from other countries look at our celebration here in the U.S. and think, what in the world, right?
Well, they do, but they also embrace it more and more all the time. Just in the last 20 years, it's been incredible to watch how much the whole world, or at least the parts of the world in the Northern Hemisphere, have really fallen in love with this holiday.
Well, it is fun. But why don't you talk a little bit about the origins of Halloween? Where did it come from?
It's a mashup of two different holidays. One is the Catholic All Saints Day, and the other is the ancient Irish Celtic celebration of Samhain. And Samhain was a New Year's celebration for the Celts, and they did indeed celebrate it on October 31st. They were bringing their livestock in from the fields. They were hunkering down for a long, cold winter, and it was a border between years. So they thought it was a time when a border between our world and another world might be at its thinnest, and on that one night, all kinds of scary things could cross over into our world. And they celebrated by telling ghost stories, and I think that is where Halloween gets its macabre side from. So when the Catholic missionaries came to Ireland to convert these Celts, they moved the date of their celebration of the saints. It used to be May 13th, and they moved it to November 1st because they'd found they were much more successful converting people if they just co-opted their existing celebrations instead of trying to stamp them out.
Uh-huh. The early Christians were good at marketing that way, weren't they?
They sure were, yeah.
So where does the word come from?
The word is one of those misconceived things I was talking about. I think a lot of people might even think it's pagan, but it is actually an abbreviated way of saying All Saints Day, because way back then, hollow was another word for saints. It doesn't really have that meaning so much anymore, but All Hallows Eve actually ended up just getting abbreviated to Halloween.
Mm-hmm. How did the Celts celebrate Samhain?
We don't know a lot about them because they didn't write down their own history, but the early Catholic missionaries wrote down what they could of the lore. And what we have of Samhain is that they celebrated with a three-day-long feast, partly because they had a lot of their livestock that they had just slaughtered in preparation for the winter, so they had a lot of food, and partly because it was New Year's, and they did indeed tell these spooky stories. And the stories might be something like a malicious creature called a she that would cross over into our world on Samhain night and try to burn the palace down. And some of these stories, you read them now, and you're like, that's still really spooky.
It is. It really is. The spookiness has certainly come through all the changes, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. I think there is a little bit of argument among people who study Halloween that It really comes mainly from the Catholic side of things, but I just don't see anything really spooky about a lot of saints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Now we're talking about other countries, and the British celebrate Guy Fawkes Night in November 5th. Tell us about that holiday and how that may be similar to Halloween.
Yeah, that dates back to 1605 when a group of conspirators tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament. They were actually trying to take out King James, and they failed, fortunately. And the guy who was caught with the 36 barrels of gunpowder underneath the Houses of Parliament was Guy Fawkes. And so the holiday, they began to commemorate it every year thereafter, and it took on his name. And what's interesting about the holiday is that in the middle of the 17th century, Parliament decided to ban all Catholic celebrations. They were trying to separate themselves from the church. So All Saints Day went away in Britain, but they kept celebrating Guy Fawkes on November 5th. And they would celebrate it by burning effigies of Guy Fawkes. And eventually kids would do a thing where they would paint their faces in soot, and they'd dress in rags, and they would go around begging either for material to build bonfires or for some spare change to be able to go out and buy fireworks. And that is a little bit like trick-or-treat, but it really doesn't have a direct connection to trick-or-treat, which comes much, much later and is strictly American.
I was kind of confused. Now, do they think of Guy Fawkes as a hero, or?
No, they don't. He's definitely the bad guy, which is why they burn him in effigy.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess they probably, but they gave him the name. His name is the celebration, so they did give him that. Yeah. Karen in Minneapolis emailed us. She just heard that Des Moines is going to be trick-or-treating again for the first time since 1938. Are there places in the U.S. that celebrate more intensely and others that have prohibitions like this one? How is that changing?
Trick-or-treat has been changing a lot over just the last 20 years or so. It has become much more regionalized. I hear this from places all over the country that it seems now like it's confined to little pockets of many cities, and people will drive their kids in from all over to go to these little pockets. And I know there are cities where they are also putting in some odd regulations, like trick-or-treat can only be held on the Thursday or Friday before the actual date of Halloween, because they don't want kids out on Halloween night when there might be a lot of rowdy adults. So that's some odd new legislation that's in place in certain places. And, of course, for a while there was even a push from retailers to move it to the Saturday night closest to Halloween, because their sales were better on Saturday nights.
Yes, I mean, there are quite a few communities in this area of our state that do trick-or-treating on the Sunday before, during the day when it's not even dark outside. Did that kind of start with the scare of, was it back in the 70s, I think, where people were talking about putting pins in, candy and all kinds of stuff like that?
Yeah, that was something that started about 1974 because of a very famous case that was in the news called the Candy Man. And this was a guy down in Texas named Ronald O'Brien who poisoned his own son with an arsenic-laced pixie stick on Halloween night in an insurance scam. And even though it was made clear that this was a one case only, a guy trying to make insurance money, it started really this whole notion of anonymous psychos out there poisoning your kids' candy. And that did definitely pull way back on trick-or-treat at that point. And there was also, in the 80s, there was a scare with poisoned Tylenol all over the country. That also contributed to people being really concerned about their kids' candy.
Well, I remember when I used to go trick-or-treating, which was eons ago, we would get things like cookies and apples and things that weren't wrapped up, but you don't get that much anymore, do you?
No, indeed not. Plus, you know, who wants to put all the time into making that kind of thing?
Very true, very true. Well, besides talking about Halloween, we're also going to be talking a little bit of the history of the paranormal. And we've got Jeff in Superior who has a little ghost story to share with us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we're talking about 12 years ago. I worked for a company called Schwann's, and one of my coworkers was delivering to a high-rise apartment building here in the Twin Ports. And while he knocked on the apartment door, down the hallway came this white ghost-like spirit or figure coming toward him. And he yelled, and it went into the wall, but he came back to the depot, and he quit that day. He says, "That's it. I'm done."
Oh, goodness. Well, thanks for sharing that, Jeff. I'm sure you've probably heard a lot of stories like that, haven't you, Lisa?
I have indeed. I've written two books on the history of the paranormal, including one called Ghost: A Haunted History. So, oh yes, I've heard many, many accounts.
And a lot of them are kind of secondhand, like that particular one was. But obviously, he saw how frightened his coworker was. But do you get a lot from people who've actually it happened to them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, when I started writing that book, I was very much the skeptic. I tended to think, well, you know, anyone who's seen a ghost has been fooled or hallucinating or something, but you can't write a global world history and read thousands and thousands of accounts without thinking, okay, wait a minute, there's something going on here. And so my form of skepticism now is that I just don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on. And I hear accounts like this, and I never just think the person is making it up or crazy or something, because it's just too common.
It is, and this has been going on for, like you said, centuries and centuries of reports of ghosts.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we can go all the way back to the ancient world and read about things like the hero Odysseus calling up ghosts in order to try and find his way home from the Trojan War.
We are talking with Lisa Morton. She's the author of three books on the history of Halloween and a bunch of others. What questions do you have or comments or ghost stories would you like to share? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Hope you can stay with us today. At noon, we'll take a closer look at horror films with a professor from UW-Milwaukee's Film School. But right now, we're talking a little bit about the history of Halloween and paranormal study. So let's go back to apparently some of the other celebrations that have been kind of rolled into what we know as Halloween. I believe there was a Roman holiday that was also in early November. Is that right?
That is another common misconception. What you hear quite often is that there was a Roman holiday dedicated to a goddess of the fruits called Pomona, and that it was celebrated around November 1st. That goes back to about the mid-19th century when there were some historians who misread things, and unfortunately it continued to be quoted down throughout the decades, but there really is no celebration, Roman celebration, in that part of the calendar. Pomona was actually a really minor deity. She didn't even have her own holiday. So, no, that part of it is, like I said, another one of those common misconceptions.
So many, especially around Halloween and celebrations like that. So thanks for setting us straight. We appreciate that. So how did Halloween make its way to the United States?
It came across with the Irish and Scottish immigrants who had to flee their homeland in the 1840s due to famine. And so they came to America, many of them, and they brought a lot of their old traditions with them. And there was an interesting way these got spread throughout America. It was due in part to magazines. There were new printing technologies in place, and American housewives were suddenly gobbling up magazines as fast as they could print them. And one of the things that the magazines would cover was interesting celebrations coming in with immigrants. And the housewives loved reading about Halloween. and they started imitating that and holding parties on Halloween for their kids mainly. And we have some descriptions of the parties that sound very sweet. The kids would get together in the afternoon, and they would pull taffy, and then by the evening they'd be telling each other some spooky ghost stories, and they sound delightful.
I've seen and read, you know, accounts of Halloween, probably Victorian times. Is that when it really started becoming part of our holiday season?
It would be Victorian times in the U.S. It was still not popular in Great Britain at that point, but it was definitely catching on here by about the end of the 19th century. And the first book that is dedicated totally to Halloween shows up in 1898, and it is indeed a party guide. And it's mainly for adults rather than for kids, and it's called Halloween, How to Celebrate It. And it talks about a lot of the things that we would recognize nowadays, like carving jack-o'-lanterns. But where it goes a little off the rails for us is it talks about carving jack-o'-lanterns out of cucumbers and apples.
Okay, I've heard of turnips before, but not
right. Don't ask me how that could have worked. I have no idea.
Yeah, cucumbers are not that large, so very intricate. Let's talk to Peter in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Is there a historical connection between trick-or-treating and wassailing? Or Peter, Paul, and Mary had a song called A Solen, which talks about going from house to house, too.
Yes, souling is something that was done mainly in Britain. It was to celebrate All Souls' Day, which is held on November 2nd. And souling, the idea was that originally beggars and then later on kids who were imitating beggars would go from house to house, and they would offer to say a prayer for your loved ones who might be trapped in purgatory, and in return they'd be rewarded with a little treat. And this practice kind of died out by the middle of the 19th century, and so it didn't really make its way to America. So there's not a direct connection there. Wassailing was a Christmas tradition that again involved some kind of performance, and there's a tradition in parts of Canada and America that sounds even closer to trick-or-treat called bell snickling, and this was another Christmas tradition where people would go to their neighbor's house and they would be in actual costumes and they would put on a performance, and it was the neighbor's job to guess who was in the costumes. And then they would be rewarded, the performers would get a little treat and so forth at the end of the evening. And again, we don't have a really direct connection to trick-or-treat. Trick-or-treat actually comes around for really different reasons, and I don't know if we want to get into that yet, but it's probably not what most people think.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Appreciate the call. If you have a question or a comment, our number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So let's get into that trick side of trick-or-treating. Where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly right. That is actually the heart of trick-or-treat, because trick-or-treat comes about in the 1930s. It is really not that old. And at that point, Halloween was being celebrated in America mainly by these boys who loved to play pranks. The Irish had also loved playing pranks on Halloween. They would do things like carve a turnip into this spooky glowing face and set it out somewhere to give someone a little fright on Halloween night. And so American boys were copying this. And by the early 20th century, it was really popular. And it started being fun. The kids would go out to like a farmer's house, and they might do something very elaborate, like disassemble the farmer's buggy and reassemble it on the roof of their barn.
Yes.
But by the 1930s, they had moved into the cities, and the pranks became vandalism. They were breaking light fixtures. They were setting fires. And they were costing cities millions of dollars worth of damage. And the cities were obviously upset and were looking for ways they could counter this. And some of the cities were saying, we're just going to ban this holiday. But fortunately, a few of them that were smarter said, well, you know what? We might be more successful if we buy these kids off. so they started experimenting with a lot of different things. Some of the cities went for big, large-scale events like parades and pageants. Some of them suggested something called house-to-house parties or progressive parties. And the idea was that a bunch of houses would get together. This was the Great Depression still, and so people didn't always have a lot of money to throw away on a party. And the first house would give the kids a really simple little costume, like just a sheet or some old rags to be a pirate or something. The next house would give them a game. The next house might give them a little treat. And this proved very successful. And so eventually, within about 10 years, that becomes trick-or-treat. And the phrase actually started in Canada, of all things, and kind of worked its way down into America. The first uses of the phrase, the kids were not even in costumes. But the phrase was, of course, indeed a literal meaning, trick, we're going to do terrible things to your house, or treat.
So where did the costumes start coming in?
The costuming is because back around the turn of the last century, people loved costuming. And we don't realize that so much nowadays, I think. But I'm always seeing people who will take any photo of an old photo of people in costume and say, well, it's Halloween. Well, no, truthfully, most of those probably are not, because people dressed in costume for birthday parties, for Christmas, for Thanksgiving, for school pageants. Costuming was very, very popular. So it was put into place in almost all holidays at some point. And so when it came time to buy these kids off, giving them a simple little costume was just kind of a natural thing.
And then when did it start getting pretty commercialized?
Yeah, that happens in the 50s. It kind of went on hiatus a little bit during World War II. And for one thing, there wasn't a lot of sugar at the time. There were a lot of wartime things that were happening to make a lot of shortages. And so it went on a little bit of a vacation, but it comes back really strong as soon as we get into the 50s. There are two things that start happening. One is that it's getting picked up in the mass media. And we, in 52, we see things like a massively successful Disney cartoon called Trick or Treat. And it starts to show up on the very earliest American sitcoms. Television was still new, but in 1952, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet did a Halloween episode. And there's a really odd, primitive-looking form of trick-or-treat. And so the other thing that is happening, though, is retailing. Retailing drives so many of these holidays, and it certainly has Halloween, because we get both these costume companies coming in and candy companies coming in. And they're both saying, hey, Mom, you know, you don't have to spend all day doing this stuff. We're going to do it for you. And, of course, the kids are like, yeah, I'd much rather be the licensed character of Superman than another pirate from Mom's old bandanas. And sure, I'd much rather have the chocolate than another popcorn ball.
Yes, that is definitely the truth. But how are things today? Are you keeping track of what some of the trends and whatnot are going on with Halloween now?
I am. It's been an interesting year for Halloween. Since the pandemic in 2020, obviously everything took a big hit that year. But the following few years, Halloween just exploded in popularity and in sales. But it peaked last year. It actually declined slightly this year. And I have a suspicion that that is probably due to the election, which is just on people's minds so much that it maybe is taking away a little bit from their enjoyment of the holiday this year. But it hasn't declined a ton. I mean, it went from last year, we peaked at about $108 per American was each American was spent on the holiday. This year, it seems to be topping out at about $104 each of us are spending on Halloween.
So that's not a lot of difference, for sure. Of course, the cost of candy has skyrocketed, too. Are people doing other things besides giving kids candy these days?
Well, in the 70s, the holiday did take another one of those kind of shifts and became much more of an adult holiday for a number of reasons. And so adults certainly are doing a lot of other things now. Haunted attractions are the next big thing you just can't ignore when it comes to Halloween. It's become a gigantic part of the holiday. There are thousands of both profit and nonprofit haunted houses all over the U.S., and that has become like a multi-billion dollar industry and is just a phenomenal thing. That's another thing that has really exploded in popularity since about the 90s and has been interesting to chart.
Yeah, this seems like there's more and more elaborate, and even decorations in neighborhoods are getting more elaborate.
They sure are. Yeah, that's part of that whole billion-dollar industry is with things like the Spirit Halloween stores springing up. And, you know, you can now go to a store and for $200 buy an audio animatronic figure of your favorite movie villain. And it's been amazing to watch that happen. And it's funny, the trend that I am seeing this year that's huge, literally, is the giant audio animatronic figures, or just figures. I think that started with the popularity of the Home Depot 12-foot skeleton.
Yes.
And there are some elaborate yard haunts in my area that are essentially like little museums of gigantic Halloween figures.
I just wonder sometimes the small front yards can hold anymore. They're so crowded.
There were a few of these that we thought, you know, it's cool, but it's almost too much.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. Well, we've been talking about Halloween, but let's switch over to paranormal. We've got Kim in Arena who's got a comment for us. Go ahead, Kim. Thanks for holding.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say our family has been dealing with ghosts for 3 decades. Our daughter, Sedona, is 30 years old, and she is a death walker. And when I first was told that by Myra Nischowski, I said, I don't know what that is, but I don't want her to be that. And he said her job is to cross folks over that can't get to heaven. And we have been doing this, and I wrote a book about it 10 years ago. It's available on Amazon or in any library. We, to this day, are dealing with this, and we have it under control now because Myron taught us how to do it in a way that we're managing the ghosts instead of the other way around, because it can be brutal. I'm sorry, I'm pulled over. That's an ambulance. So anyway, it's for real, and it's something that we no firsthand exists. So that's all I wanted to share.
Great. Thank you, Kim. What is a ghost walker, Lisa?
That actually is the first time I've ever heard that term. Okay. When Kim explained it, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of another term for a medium, I think.
Mm-hmm. Kim, are you still with us?
Yes. It's a death walker. That's the, you know, official name of it. But it also has to do with the whole idea of psychopomp. So, and I didn't know what that was either. I thought that was a rock band. I'm like, no, this isn't making any sense to me at all. But it's a death walker in the area of psychopomp.
Okay. And Kim, can you explain both of those to us? Because like you, I have never heard those terms before.
Sure. Well, a death walker is someone who literally walks the ghosts over to heaven. Sedona sees a very bright light, and if you've ever seen the film or the series Ghost Whisperer, it is very much like that. So that's what a death walker is. They escort dead ones to heaven that can't get there on their own. Now, psychopomp, I'm not even sure about that, but Myron gave me a book on psychopomp, and it outlined, because I had no idea. There isn't literature on any of this stuff. So he was kind enough to give me a book which outlined, you know, the psychopomp area, which basically just has all to do with past lives and
okay. Well, sounds like it's getting a little noisy there, Kim. So, but thank you very much for sharing that with us. We appreciate it. Lisa, any comments?
Psychopomp, I actually do know. That's an old tradition, often presented in the form of a bird being something that accompanies the soul to heaven when a person dies. So that one I do know, and that goes back a ways.
Okay. So you've written about the supernatural as well as the Halloween. How long have humans been trying to communicate with the dead?
Oh, right from the beginning. We can go all the way back to the story of Gilgamesh from the ancient Assyrians and see ghost stories. In Gilgamesh, there is one episode in which his friend Enkidu goes to the netherworld and comes back, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. His friend returns from the realm of the dead and says, if I told you everything that goes on there, you would sob. And it really is quite heartrending. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we can go up to the ancient Greeks with Odysseus, and the ancient Romans had some really odd and interesting beliefs. So, yes, people have always been trying to communicate with the dead. And what's interesting is how it changes in the middle of the 19th century, because before that, trying to talk to a dead spirit was usually something that was done alone. It was a solitary act that would be performed by a magician, or maybe a magician had told you how you could do it. But then in the middle of the 19th century, for the first time, we get the seance. And that is absolutely mind-blowingly different. Never before had people thought they could communicate with the dead by just sitting around a table.
And how much of that was people taking advantage of people who missed their loved ones?
Oh, yes, that was an absolutely astonishing amount of fraud that went on, and especially in the spiritualist movement of the 19th century. And when I wrote a book called Calling the Spirits, A History of Seances, and I always joke now that by the time I was halfway through that book, I started saying this should be subtitled A History of Fraud. mediums within that movement in the 19th century were absolute superstars. They were like the rock stars of our day. They had many fans. They often became fairly wealthy, but they were very adept at pulling the rug out mm-hmm. from under people or the wool over their eyes. And the ways that they did it were really interesting to study. But I think the most interesting thing I discovered was how spiritualists would react when their favorite medium was debunked, which happened a lot. And they would say these crazy things like, oh, no, I know that they're real. That was the one day it wasn't working for them, and so they had to resort to trickery, but it was only that one time.
Now, there are some people that it seems like, obviously there's no proof, and I'm just saying, but it seems like they actually can communicate with those who have gone, or that know things ahead of time, psychics, that type of thing. How much have you run across those people in your research?
Well, there definitely are people who seem to have some interesting abilities. In the history of paranormal research, there has often been a thought that they may actually be doing ESP, demonstrating ESP, and not talking to the spirits of the dead. That when they are saying, hey, your Uncle Bob is here and he always loved that Jaguar car, they may be picking that up from the people sitting with them rather than from a dead spirit. And there obviously is no concrete proof of this one way or the other. So it's kind of up to you as to what you want to believe. And I suspect that there are things that we are going to find out in the future that may be even more neurological than anything else.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're talking with our guest today is Lisa Morton. She is the author of 3 books on the history of Halloween. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Aaron Presley is back to talk about herbs. And then at noon, we'll take our 12:30, we'll take a deep dive into how to grow bonsai trees. That's tomorrow, starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about Halloween and paranormal. If you've got any questions or stories you'd like to share with us, you can give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Somebody sent an interesting word to me today, and I did hear you earlier talk a little bit about, you know, what the origins of this word were, but it's Samhainophobia. which is, I guess, an abnormal fear of Halloween. And I find that really interesting because, you know, it's a phobia about a holiday, which is all about fear, basically. So there's kind of some irony there. But I was with the screener when you were discussing after that last phone call about the psychic. And I just want to say, I think it's really important not to kind of massage topics like that. And I was really surprised to hear the host kind of reply to your guest there when she was kind of doing that, kind of massaging the idea of psychics. It's important to say, you know, that's not real. It's astounding how convinced the caller was that, you know, this is truly a thing. And I think it's just important to say that psychics aren't real. And there's a good YouTuber who actually specifically handles topics like that. Her name is Skepchick, S-K-E-P-C-H-I-C-K, Rebecca Watson, but she goes by Skepchick on YouTube, and she has an episode on psychics and talks about how it's not just fun and games, but, you know, people can really, really be hurt by being convinced that somebody is communicating with their dead relatives. And I just wanted to make that point.
Okay, thank you for your opinion, Laura. What do you think about that, Lisa?
Well, it certainly is a case that many psychics are fraudulent. And yes, we absolutely should be aware of that. And they do prey on people. And it's absolutely terrible. It's been going on forever. But, I mean, I have also encountered people who did things that I could not explain. So my interest is always, yes, we should protect the innocent from being rooked by these people, but I also want to know what's going on in some of these cases that you just look at and you go, well, I don't know what just happened there.
Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of those stories out there. And like you said, you just don't understand at some point. We're not all seeing, right? what about Day of the Dead? That's coming up, and that has become pretty big with people out there from Mexico, correct?
Yes, Dia de los Muertos, and it is an absolutely beautiful holiday. It's a very interesting thing because it's like what you get if you take the Celtic influence out of Halloween and you replace it with indigenous American people, the Aztecs, the Mayans. The idea with Dia de los Muertos was very similar insofar as missionaries are coming to a new world to convert people, and they are trying to co-opt their existing celebrations with their own. In the case of the missionaries coming into Mexico, All Souls Day was, I think, probably closer to some of the existing celebrations, and it kind of morphed with Aztec and Mayan festivals. And it becomes a holiday in which people are honoring their own deceased loved ones. And they also mock death, which is why you see so many of the images of grinning skulls. And La Catrina being probably the most famous one. That's the woman with the plumed hat. And it is also a holiday, though, when the people would go to graveyards and they would decorate and clean the tombs and the graves of loved ones. And they would set up kind of little altars at home called ofrendas, which are like memorials to your loved ones with the things that they loved.
And that's, some cultures do that, don't they? Take a picnic, go to the cemetery.
They do, and in, for example, in parts of Europe, they still celebrate All Saints Day that way.
Why do you think it is that we are so concerned, or I don't know what the word would be, about people that have gone before us, and what is that it's sort of like a human thing that we want to know what happened to our friends and relatives?
Well, of course, I think that plays into grief. And when you lose someone that you love, obviously you would like to think that there's a chance you'll see them again and that they might be with you in some form. And this is indeed, as the caller mentioned, where psychics, unscrupulous psychics, can play on people. But I also have read of psychics who provided comfort to people that way, and those tended to be the ones who did not charge money, by the way.
Right.
But yeah, it's, I think it is a universal human thing that obviously when we lose a loved one, we feel like we would do anything to get them back, if even only for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm, for sure. We kind of talked a little bit about the whole Halloween pumpkin thing. We talked about pumpkins this week. But how did that start? And it's become so, it's like they're artists that are doing this. How did it go from, you know, that turnip to these wonderful pieces of art?
Well, the idea behind the jack-o'-lantern, it is based on a very old folktale that's found all over the world in hundreds of variants. In most of the versions of it, it is a guy named Jack, and Jack is a bad guy, and he is someone who outwits the devil three times from taking his soul. So when Jack finally dies, of course, heaven doesn't want to let this guy in, but the devil is mad at him and doesn't want him either. And so he goes to hell, and the devil says, well, I'm not letting you in, but look, I'll do this much for you. I'll give you this burning ember from the hellfires, and you can use this to light your way. So Jack puts this burning hell ember in a carved-out gourd. Now, of course, in Ireland, they didn't have pumpkins because those are indigenous to the New World. And so they were carving these turnips, and it was something they did at Halloween, as I mentioned earlier, for a playful scare. Someone stumbling across this carved glowing turnip at night on Halloween would probably have associated it with the story of Jack because it was so common then. And when the Irish and the Scottish came to America and saw these gorgeous big orange pumpkins here, that was the obvious choice to carve their jack-o'-lanterns. And by the end of the 19th century, we get it pretty, coming in pretty firmly in place, even though there were those occasional, we can carve jack-o'-lanterns out of apples or cucumbers or whatever. But and it really gets spread in the early 20th century with things like retailing again, with decorating guides. There were companies like the Denison's Paper Company that were making lots of decorations that featured pumpkins, and people were communicating a lot then via postcards because telephones were still kind of scarce. And there were thousands of Halloween postcards, and many of them featured pumpkins.
Quite a few people are collectors of some of that old Halloween memorabilia, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Yes, guilty as charged. it's just beautiful stuff, much of it, and it is insanely expensive now. Back when I was starting to research Halloween, you could still pick up some of these beautiful vintage postcards for fairly cheap, and now some of them will bring just hundreds of dollars, and some of the higher-end collectibles like old candy collectors or old noisemakers may bring thousands of dollars.
Do you have a Halloween tradition that's that you do every year?
We love to do a little yard haunt. I am in Southern California, where we yard haunts are huge here, in part because so many people are in the film industry.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, and so you get some incredibly elaborate things here because the guy living in the house might be a lighting designer or something for film. And we do obviously nothing that elaborate because we're not lighting designers, but we just love to set up our yard as a fun little graveyard that's very family friendly. And we get a few of the same families who show up every year to see what we've changed, and we'll make their kids pose in the graveyard for a picture. And it's fun to watch the kids kind of get scared, but ooh, this is fun. And
do you dress up?
This is horrific, I know, and shocking, but no, I don't. I think the reason I don't like the costume at Halloween is that it is such a busy time for me that I just really wouldn't have the time to put into a great costume, and I'm probably too much of a perfectionist to go out with something that's just a little bit half-baked.
So no sheets over the head with two eye holes.
Right.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about ghosts and unexplained things. And when you did your research for the books that you've written, are there things that are in common to some of these sightings or experiences that people have had?
There are. It's interesting to see some of the things that show up. Footsteps, of course. The drop in temperature is interesting. One of the ones I find really perplexing is the idea that many of these haunted places will drain your batteries on your electronic devices. And I actually had that happen on the Queen Mary, which, of course, is supposed to be very haunted. I drove down there a few years ago, and I had made sure when I left that my camera and my little digital camera and my phone and everything were completely charged. And 2 hours after I checked in at the ship, they were dead. And it's like, okay, that is weird. I don't know why that would be, but it often does show up in connection with these haunted places. And then, of course, you know, if you want to get into some of the gadgety stuff, which I am pretty skeptical about, although it's fun to see flashy lights. The whole thing with setting off K2 meters that read electromagnetic frequency and are really just designed for use around a household.
Sure. Have you experienced anything else when you've been out and about, you know, the hair rising on your neck or chills, anything like that?
I had one experience that I cannot completely explain that was one of those things where you go, okay, maybe I'm a little bit less skeptical after that one, but it was at the Stanley Hotel in Colorado, and it is a place that is, again, supposedly very haunted and was the inspiration for Stephen King to write The Shining. And I was doing an overnight investigation there, and at the time I was researching my book, Ghost of Haunted History. And so we were in one of the outbuildings, a concert hall at the Stanley Hotel at about 3 in the morning, and we were using a device called a spirit box, which is like a transistor radio that rapidly scans radio frequencies, and most of it just sounds like a wash of white noise, but it occasionally blurts out words. And of course, believers think that those words are spirit communication. And nothing had been happening for a while, and suddenly this thing blurted out a word that sounded like Mostellaria, which only I would have known was the Latin name that translated to the haunted house. It's the name of a famous play from the Romans. And that obviously was like, what the heck was that doing coming out of this speaker at 3 in the morning in the middle of the Colorado Rockies? And I suspect it was a case of something called pareidolia, which is our human brain's tendency to make patterns out of things that don't really have a pattern. But even that fascinates me. I find that absolutely astonishing that my brain could have done that to me.
Yes. Well, I've been on a couple of ghost tours myself, and mostly they're just kind of fun to learn the history of a place. But there
exactly.
have been a couple of times where the shivers and, you know, the hair on your arms are standing up. And I've had friends who've had experiences that are similar to that and have actually seen things, and I believe them completely. So, you know, putting myself out there, I think there are definitely things that we're not aware of. Next up, we're going to be talking about scary movies. Do you have a favorite scary movie?
I do. That would be The Exorcist.
Okay. I think that's probably on a lot of people's list. Why do you think we like to be scared?
I think it is, we like to be scared. Let's clarify that a little bit. We like to be scared in a safe environment.
Yes.
obviously, nobody wants to be really scared. But when it comes to things like horror movies or Halloween or haunted attractions, you are in a safe environment. And it's a way to test your fears, and you come out on the other end and you have survived and you've maybe even had a laugh or a good time, and you say, you know what, that wasn't so bad. and so I think it's can be, at an extreme end, it can even be somewhat cathartic and transformative.
For sure, like riding a roller coaster, kind of the same thing.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge with us. We really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I enjoyed our chat.
You bet. We've been talking to Lisa Morton. If you're interested in her books, just look up her name, Lisa, like you always spell it, M-O-R-T-O-N. And stay with us. There's more spooky stuff ahead. Happy Halloween. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. We've got a treat for you coming up. We're talking about scary movies. And if you're not sure what that music is, we'll remind you in just a bit. Our guest is Kelly Kirshner. She's here to help us celebrate the holiday. She's an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. She's an associate professor of film, video, animation, and new genres at UW-Milwaukee. What movies have really scared you? What do you want to know about how the filmmakers make us feel afraid? We'll be part of the conversation. Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Happy Halloween.
So is this one of your favorite holidays?
It is. I already went to at least one haunted prom already.
Oh, did you? At least. Then there's more in your future.
I do love dressing up, so I do special effects makeup as well, so it's my favorite time of year.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, I mean, because sometimes that special effects makeup, it doesn't look like a special effect. It looks very real. That's wonderful.
Exactly.
We just, you know, heard the music from Psycho, in case you all were scratching your head wondering. And I got to tell you, I minored in film in college, and Hitchcock is one of my absolute favorite filmmakers. And I think probably a lot of people think of him as maybe like the father of movies, suspenseful movies like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I definitely think that Hitchcock kind of brought, an approach to horror film that was sort of, horror films were B movies, which meant they were sort of second rate and they weren't part of the art of filmmaking. And Hitchcock is the one who sort of brought the horror movie into cinematic sort of history in a way that other filmmakers hadn't. And so that's a very important moment for suspense films. And if we watch Psycho today, of course, it plays out very differently pace-wise and with its jump scares and everything, very different than what we expect from horror today. But Hitchcock's whole approach to suspense was basically to do as much as possible to manipulate the audience's sensibilities. And so, and I think he did that very well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Psycho was so different. I think one of the favorite things that I've read about it, and hopefully it's true, is that they would not let people come in to the movie in the middle of it like they had done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of the mystique also of certain kinds of horror films, where you have not only is the audience controlled in the theater, but also they, you know, as much as you can have them hanging on the edge of their seats. Because one thing about audiences is that we're all very good at decoding certain kinds of genre tropes, you know,
yes.
The things that we expect
yes.
to see. We're good at that. And so when you have the ability to control those expectations and then actually surprise people like Hitchcock did all the time, that's a really important part of the experience. So, he liked to control all sorts of aspects of filmmaking and audience viewing process.
Yeah, very controlling director for sure. Before Hitchcock came out with some of his movies, what was the usual way that horror was used in a film? I'm thinking, you know, I know we can go back all the way to Nosferatu, obviously. How did that change during the different decades of horror?
Well, this is it's a very big question, but I'll try to kind of truncate my answer. But so the thing about the horror genre to begin with is that it looks and tries to play upon the fears and experiences of its audience. And so with Nosferatu and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, for example, the 1920s films, both of those are responding to, events and elements of the world culturally and socially at the time. It was the time of psychoanalysis coming out, and it was a time of fear of disease and all sorts of other kinds of things that people would be experiencing in their daily lives. After this time period, we go, we could, in America at least, we see the classic Hollywood horror cycle, which includes Frankenstein and Dracula and those films that were coming out in the 1930s. And again, these are escapist fantasies to help people kind of make it through the Great Depression and provide, horrors that are not in your daily world, but sort of far afield. Frankenstein and Dracula were kind of set in a European landscape. So for Americans, it was kind of a departure from their daily lives, whatever that would consist of. And what's interesting about horror in general is that the horror genre rises and falls in popularity as directors sort of oversaturate with certain kinds of monsters or something like that. So if you have Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman who are frightening their viewers and the Mummy, and then you saturate with battles between Frankenstein and the Wolfman and Dracula, and you have all these things that push the horror genre then towards parody and comedy. And so what that means at that point is that directors need to find the new way to kind of get the audiences on the edge of their seat. And what happened in the 1940s is kind of turned inward to psychological horrors with a film like Cat People. And that was another thing that had a supernatural origin in Europe, but it was now placed in America. And then so we have a lot of exploration of psychological themes in the 1940s. At the same time, those classical horror monsters like Frankenstein were still battling it out in their own genre, subgenres. In the 50s, in the 50s, we have aliens. And in the 60s, we get the zombies. And so that kind of brings us almost up to date.
It does. It does. Where would like the movie King Kong, how would that fit in?
That fits in with it's a hybrid genre that was really focused on the ability of filmmakers and the special effects wizards like O'Brien to create a monster that in our own world that just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And So, again, it's all based in people's fears. It's the fear of, and in that case, a fear of the other, a fear of the foreign other coming and, taking the innocent, woman. And these are tropes. The horror genre is based on these archetypes of villains and, the good guys. And that kind of becomes more complicated as we move towards our time period, because especially with Hitchcock, going back to Hitchcock, Hitchcock was a big fan of the kind of sympathetic killer. So we empathize with Norman Bates because he was a problem child, right? And then he grew up to be a problem adult. But we kind of go from these black and white sort of ideas of good and evil to a very complex idea of how the killer is sort of created by social problems or by society. And so that's why horror becomes a lot more complex after the 1960s, I would say.
So when we talked about Psycho, now that was a black and white movie. And at the time, You didn't get a lot of black and white movies. Do you think that black and white movies are scarier in some ways than color movies are?
It's funny. I think that for our sensibilities, when we see black and white, it sort of puts it into a nostalgic mode, and it allows us to kind of, I think a black and white ghost story or a story that's based in more suspense is something that works really well in black and white and is still very scary today. But the, you know, when you come around to the Technicolor sort of approaches in the 60s and 70s, where that coincides with the increase of gore and blood, and being able to see that on screen is something that kind of also changes the horror genre. But you look at Night of the Living Dead, that's black and white, mm-hmm. and that's still very, very scary.
Right.
It's the way that everything is withheld in that movie. Everything's in just one house, a few rooms, and then you have black and white, just a few characters. And so you really kind of get immersed in this world. So, I think it just depends on how the movie's cinematography interacts with either color or black and white.
And we think a lot about, you know, the directors of scary films, but really the cinematographers, the lighting people really had a big effect on it, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think some of the ways that horror is delivered is through shadow, the withholding of, you know, whatever's scary just off screen, the withholding of sound or the presence of sound. All sorts of ways that filmmakers are able to manipulate the image, and those are the things that they can show us or take away. And you know, so the typical idea of somebody opening up one side of the fridge, and then when you close it, audiences are at this point expecting to see the killer right there, right behind the door. And that's one of those things. That's a kind of a typical expectation. So you can use it or not. But the cinematographers are thinking a lot about how do you frame an image that we understand that there might be something just off screen.
Because that is certainly important in any movie. And the part of it is not guessing that ahead of time, right?
Right. Or, you know, if you think about it, the best way to kind of get an audience is to give them something they do recognize. And then to play with that and
right.
surprise them despite themselves, right? So
yes,
yeah,
that's great. We are talking about scary movies, what makes them so, what we like about them, and our guest is Kelly Krishner. She is a artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. We'd love to hear from you, so give us a call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or maybe want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry, and you can hear recordings of our broadcasts, and they go way back. Right now, we're talking about scary movies, and Kelly, we've got a lot of callers, so let's go right to Jonah in Little Chute. Go ahead, Jonah.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What do you want for, or what question or comment do you have?
So I'm a big believer in the journey is more important than the destination for horror movies. My favorite kinds of horror movies are the ones that make you wait an obscene amount of time for an actual quote unquote scare to happen.
Sure.
Movies that I think of like this are the first one like this I ever fell in love with was The Witch or The Vavitch, 2015. Barely anything happens in that movie, and yet it is one of the scariest films I've ever seen because you're constantly on edge. It's amazing the slow pans where you think something's going to be revealed or jump out at you, but it just never happens. And that's not really a spoiler. It's hard to explain how that movie feels. Same with Skinamarink in 2022. Can't recommend it enough. Both of those films and ones like it just tap into the fears inside your mind more than, you know, anything the directors or the effects people could cook up. Your brain is your own worst enemy.
Absolutely. I think Hitchcock was big on that one, too. Thank you, Jonah. Kelly, what do you have to say about that?
Oh, I absolutely agree with The Witch. I think with so many subgenres of horror, you're going to find people making connections with all sorts of different things. But with The Witch, I agree. It's about the mood and about the building of suspicion and tension. And this idea that it taps into some really deep fears rely on whether or not you're correctly identifying what reality is or not. And that's part of what The Witch is about. It's sort of like, are you believing what's being shown to you, or are you believing the paranoid sort of fantasies of the people surrounding the main character? And so, yeah.
And there's a number of movies like that. What are your thoughts on the Blair Witch Project?
Oh, I liked that. I think I watched it when it first came out, and it was one of those, it was part of a bunch of those handheld sort of genres,
yes,
experiential things. And I think that that also helps people kind of be put in the position of the people who are exploring. I think anytime you have a limitation on the screen, or a limitation of sight or environment, it's going to kind of build up the idea of tension. That's why there's a more recent film called The Descent, where it happens underground in these caves. And, you know, the idea of limited ability to see or feel or hear or escape, you know, that all adds up.
That is terrorizing to me, because of the thought of being underground. Yeah, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's kind of what it does too, right? It finds that certain thing that terrifies you and just keeps popping it and giving it to you.
Yeah, I mean, humans are very good at having a lot of things that we secretly or outwardly fear.
Right.
And so the horror genre intersects with those in any possible combination we can think of.
Let's go to the phones again. We've got Matt and Eloise. Hi, Matt.
Hi, I'm glad I can riff off of what the last guy said. Those feelings of having, you know, a fear about something really common. And like when I was a kid and I would ride in the back of the car at night, there would be these lights coming on the window, and it was kind of creepy looking. You know, you might even think you saw a face in it. Well, there's a movie that does that, and it's called Carnival of Souls. And it plays off of all of these little fears that we have. And like one of the things that also creeped me out when I was a kid was being raised up on one of those hydraulic lifts at a service station to check the underside of the car. And that happens in Carnival of Souls. And I'd have to say that the creepy movie or the spooky movie, like Carnival of Souls or Hitchcock's Rebecca, is much more watchable, it's much more interesting, and it creeps you out for a lot longer time than a jump film does.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. Matt, what do you think, Kelly?
Well, Rebecca is one of my all-time favorite
Me too.
Films. Well, I think especially with Carnival of Souls is such a great film to bring up, because it kind of, the idea of the face in the window and the idea of what we might like believe or not believe, there's a lot of misidentifications that we might have in our daily lives. I don't know if you've ever caught sight of yourself in a mirror in the store and not recognized it as yourself, but it's some of these things that happen in real life, and they bring it into a horror film, and they sort of make it this moment of you deciding whether you can trust your own senses or not. And when you have a film that's based on mood, you slowly realize that, no, you can't, you know, trust your senses, and that what you're experiencing, you are in a brand new world in a way. So the suspense genre, I mean, it's used in many different genres. Suspense is used in many different kinds of films, but when it's used well in horror, it's one of those things that really, really builds and builds. And
yeah.
Very effective.
For sure. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate that. Nina in Menasha, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There are two movies that, one, I'm not into slasher films. I mean, that's cool, but the gore isn't my thing. It's the suspense and the wondering. And the movie that still terrifies me to this day, and I'm like 50, is What Lies Beneath, that came out in 2000 with Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer. It deals with the supernatural. That terrifies me because my whole family has witnessed stuff as a group that can't be explained. My brother lived in a haunted house. And the other, the freaky one is sort of gory, is from 1982, the Kurt Russell version of The Thing. That was terrifying.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Nina. Kelly?
I would say The Thing is another favorite of mine. There's something about, again, not being able to know if you're friends or your friends anymore, and not being able to, and again, John Carpenter is really good with kind of dealing out the scares. But in that case, the special effects were used to, they're very, very effective, and they were done to such a level that in other horror films might have been like a cheap scare. But this takes the model of this alien sort of influence that we have no like grounds for understanding, and yet it is able to take the form of, you know, people you know really well, and not knowing who is who and what is what, again, it plays upon those deep, deep fears that perhaps your friend is not your friend. Perhaps this person is not who they say they are.
Yeah. That the Invasion of the Body Snatchers is similar to that too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about movies like The Sixth Sense or others? What kind of genre would you put those in?
Those are kind of, I would call it a creepy ghost supernatural. it's the hybrid, I would call it.
Okay.
But yeah, I still remember the kind of a reveal in The Others where you finally, because the whole movie goes on and it's not really explaining a lot of the points that it's kind of showing you. And then when the big reveal is done, it's one of those moments where you're like, well, of course, why didn't I think of that sooner?
Yes.
But yeah, and The Sixth Sense is another thing. I mean, the same kind of thing, the reveal actually, finally, all the pieces, the puzzle pieces go together. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to say my claim to fame is that I figured out The Sixth Sense like a quarter of the way through.
Yeah.
But then I had to reveal it to the people I was with, and they were not happy with me. So,
no, of course not.
Let me do a public apology to them right now. So, Christina in Madison has a question. Go right ahead, Christina.
Hi there. I really appreciate this conversation. It's very illuminating, and I like the psychological approach. Just a second. I'm just coming in with my dog. Can you hold for just 1 second?
Sure. That's a new one on me. Well, let's just go to an email real quick. Troy in Lake Geneva called but couldn't stay with us. He says that there's a long history of literature being adapted into horror films. What makes a successful book to movie adaptation, in your opinion?
Oh, gosh. I think a successful adaptation is something that's not going to translate some of the extensive kind of inner thoughts that you have in writing and be able to translate that into how do we show this? And more important than that is what do we show versus what we hear? How do we deliver those same sorts of, you know, sensibilities in the through line of the book? How do we deliver that in film? And, you know, mostly when people are not a big fan of an adaptation, it's because their imagination has gone wild with the written word. And there's just a way that this needs to be translated on the screen. And so just to make sure that you kind of get those main points, and then you translate those into how the horror genre can, you know, deliver sound and image. But
Do you think it's much more difficult when a novel is really well known? I mean, let's take Jaws, for instance. At the time, mm-hmm. it was huge. And then the movie comes out. It's like, how does the filmmaker take what was in the movie or the book and translate it, even though we know how it ends, sort of?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I remember I read Jaws before I ever saw that movie, and I was young, but I mean, I don't know why my parents were letting me read Jaws, but anyway.
They hadn't read it, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that at the beginning of Jaws, there's a whole part where the woman who whose death opens up the movie, there's a whole sort of character, you know, she has thoughts, she has feelings, there are things that she's going through, and there's a reason she goes out into the ocean. And all of that is sort of pushed aside in a movie. You just basically start with the person or the people in the water. And, you know, so you kind of, part of those things are going to be cut out because the horror genre, the tropes of the horror genre is like, well, we deliver the kind of punch that starts the narrative, and that would be the death mm-hmm. of the person who doesn't show up again. So we don't need to have that information. And that's basically, you know, cutting certain things out. And then, you know, Jaws is, by our standards today, you know, you might see that it has a slow pace in some sections. So those are the sections where you really are kind of letting the audience kind of slow down and sit with characters for a while before the action really ramps up, so that you kind of have an investment in that. So I think a filmmaker who's doing an adaptation for, you know, a screenplay or something is having to make a lot of choices and trying to figure out how the audience is going to be reading the story in general.
And some directors obviously have a better feel for it than others do. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
Well, Christina in Madison has her dog in her house now. So go ahead, Christina. What was your question?
I am so sorry for that rudeness.
No problem. It's just unusual.
I know. I was just sort of confronted with the door and, you know, in the wind.
Not a problem. Go right ahead.
Now, I did not get to hear. I got to hear you up to where you were approaching the 70s and beyond. And I was expecting some commentary about Halloween. The film,
uh-huh.
Halloween.
Did you have a question about it, or you just want us to talk about it?
Well, two things. One is, in general, I love the approach of looking at these films from really what scares us is the psychological aspect, right, of these films. And I love that. I love that part of the discussion. Now, as far as Halloween goes, and now it reminds me of Jaws also, are these sequels. I think that they debase the art of the original film. I mean, and I think that the people who exploit that for cash are really doing a very bad thing.
Okay. Thank you, Christina. Kelly, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that in the 1970s, and it's good that you mentioned Jaws, and also we have, you know, other films that are coming out in the 70s, you know, 1978 with Halloween, we've got a new model of producing things in Hollywood at that time. It goes from being a model of, you know, studios funding a lot of different kinds of projects, both A-level and B-level, so different genres, horror films. And then, you know, basically 1974, 1975, the model changes to the blockbuster model. And so they start putting more money for fewer films. And at the same time, you've got the independent film market sort of still going where, you know, it's self-funded and you know, smaller projects are being done over there. So when you have the blockbuster model, the idea is you make as much money as you can through not just ticket sales, but franchising and, you know, the toys you can bring home from the screening. If you remember, you know, Star Wars, which is not a horror film, but it's right around the same time. So Halloween is kind of an important part of the production of that time, that not only did it kind of happen at the same time as all these blockbuster things, but you have the director kind of playing upon the idea that the killer could be anywhere, could be anyone. It could, you know, they could be hidden. And again, they're the escaped mental patient angle. So I think that then when you have sequels of a movie like that, we're following the arc of a story that began way back when. So it is about making money. And when you have a franchise like Friday the 13th, where things just get crazier over time, it's one of the ways that the horror genre as a field can make money in context with the blockbuster model of filmmaking at the time. So that's sort of a broad answer, but it's one of the reasons why sequels became the thing for horror.
Sure, sure. I mean, once you get entrenched or involved in the characters too, you want to see what happens to them, and that's part of it. So let's talk about, from a technical filmmaking standpoint here, what are some of the techniques that directors use to create these, you know, suspense and unease when we're watching a movie?
So again, I'll just bring it back to, what are we able to see and what are we able to hear? So when you're talking about the techniques of filmmaking, you're going to have often low lighting, or if it's well lit, you're having a restricted view given to you by the camera. Sometimes the cuts, the editing, can be more quick at some times, so that maybe you flash on something, but you don't really catch sight of it. You know, you catch something out of the corner of your eye, as you might put it, and that's all done through sort of editing. So the editing can change speeds. You can sit in one space for a while, like I talked about with Jaws, but then perhaps something else happens very, very quickly, and your brain is still trying to make sense of it. And at the same time, sound is really, really important, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I am a sound person, so I really appreciate the ways that directors have offered clues, and sometimes very fleshed out clues, and also points of horror that will be just off screen or in the next room or unidentifiable from above in an empty house, you know. So and also there are things like the film called The Changeling back in the 70s. It was there are certain kinds of sounds that you would hear repeated throughout the film without knowing what was causing those sounds. And when you finally get the reveal of what's causing the sound, that is the crux of the horror of the movie. And sometimes it takes the whole movie to get there. But it's based on sound. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sound. I mean, if you've ever seen a movie, you know, saw Jaws without the music, or Psycho, going back to that again, it's just not the same, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Psycho also, you brought it up. So, the ubiquitous shower scene, and I like to joke with my students that I kill that actress like at least twice a semester, because I show this scene both to sound students and, you know, the visual.
Sure.
But the violins that stand in, they're shrieks, and they stand in for her screams at some point. And the music itself is kind of on a descending note, you know, do 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 do, and you're kind of the whole thing comes together in one moment that where screams are both sound effects and the voice, but there's no words, and then the violins are adding to that, and they're screeching. Yeah, so all of this is just a mesh of sound at that point. That's going along with the image. And then at the end of that scene, you're left with just the regular old shower, you know,
kind
of splashing in the tub, and it's all horrifyingly normal.
Yeah, and what always surprises me out of that is that you do never see the knife penetrating the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all in your head. But people will say, oh, no, obviously, it's you, you know, but it's like, no, go back.
Yeah, that is typical Hitchcock. And that sort of thing has been used in other films as well, just where you insist you saw something and you could go back again and again. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre is another film where the title indicates a lot more, you know, bloodshed than the film actually has. But there's a moment where you insist you see something happen, and you just don't. If you go back and look at it, that moment never happens. Nothing ever penetrates the flesh. You know?
Right. Yes. It's amazing. We've got Adam in Oshkosh.
Great.
Go ahead, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a slight twist. I just want more of your comment on it rather than it being a question. And that's finding the absurdity in horror movies, whether you go back to, I guess, Bugs Bunny or even SpongeBob now, where they make fun of ghosts and where they're not scary and they're proven to be absurd. Or I saw it last night during the World Series, the insurance commercial. You're in a horror movie, you make poor decisions. You know, let's hide behind those chainsaws. or even the Young Frankenstein. So I just, you know, I guess you can kind of tell when that started up. Or, you know, the Three Stooges meet Frankenstein. It seems to me when the black and whites in the 30s came out, probably Looney Tunes glommed onto it right away and said, ah, here's something we can make fun of. But just wondering what your comment and what your thoughts are on that.
Great. Thanks, Adam. Sure. Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, so going back to my comments on we as audiences are really good at decoding horror. And when you have these moments where it is basically playing to our knowledge, they know we know that it's ghosts are scary, right? And that commercial is a really great example, but also the movie Scream, where they outwardly talk about what the rules are for watching horror. Like you never say, or for being in a horror movie, you know, you never say, I'll be right back, you know, because you're not. And so the parody angle is a way for us to kind of both embrace our knowledge about a genre and kind of like laugh about our expectations. But then using Scream as another example, the reason it sort of broke new ground in the horror genre is because it did this and then it still subverted our expectations at the end. For Bugs Bunny and everything, that's I would say a more enjoyable, you know, it's meant to be sort of for kids. But Scream did it really well. And also Evil Dead 2, which is Bruce Campbell as Ash Williams. And that movie is really absurd. It goes way over the top. It takes our expectations and pushes it way in the realm of the campy, sort of excessive. So instead of just the walls bleeding, you're going to have the walls gushing, and it's just humorous.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, and I have to say, I'm not a big fan of like the slasher movies. I saw the original Halloween back in the theater when it came out, and I thought it was hilarious that this was just so. Right. I went back and explained this to my friends, and I was just laughing the whole way. But Scream, I really have to give them so much credit because that opening scene with Drew Barrymore is really creepy, and then bringing the humor into it, excellent. It was a really excellent, excellent film. Let's go to an email. We had Kat in Green Bay who emailed us, and she said she's not much of a horror fan, although she does love psychological thrillers. She did take a women in film class in college, and she says she'll never forget the disturbing Hitchcock quote that says, he said, blondes make the best victims. They're like the virgin snow that shows up the bloody footprints. And she wants to know if you have any insight into women in the horror film industry that you'd like to share with us. And that's definitely a big topic there, too.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that question. Looking for an excuse to talk about it. It's true that there are these archetypes in horror, and it's true that the blonde female virgin is one of them, and there's the black person dying first is another one. There are a lot of different kinds of tropes that have been kind of churned out by like many, many, many horror films. But then you have films that will respond to this by having a strong female character who, despite all odds, is going to survive. So the final survivor used to be called, in the literature, would be called the final girl. And it's somebody who kind of subverts the tropes that you expect. So, for example, in the slasher film, everyone knows that if you have sex, you must die. And the final girl is often somebody who shows less interest in that or doesn't have a boyfriend or is, you know, stays home while her friends are partying. And it doesn't have to be a girl either. It's a capital G. So just the final survivor of these films. But those sorts of characters, as they've moved away from just slasher films, have become a lot more complex and a lot more, they are able to handle their trauma. And then you get also films like Babadook. Babadook is all about, you know, this woman's grief, but it's grief kind of made flesh in a way, where you have this Babadook, the ghost who comes out of this book. And, you know, her world is falling apart, but it offers a view into, this film offers a view into things like grief, motherhood, you know, subverting expectations for things like that. And you end up empathizing a lot with the, you know, the woman's position in the book. You understand difficulties that women might encounter in their daily roles that other films may not necessarily kind of deal with properly. So, mm-hmm. So I think these things have, you know, there's opportunities anyway for people to change how these tropes are actually handled, and also the meaning of the judgments that every horror film kind of, you know, makes on its characters.
Yeah. Thank you for that email, Kat. We're talking with Kelly Kirshner. She's about scary movies. She's an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. Tell us what you like about scary movies. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again tomorrow on Garden Talk. Aaron Presley's back to help you with growing herbs. And then at 12:30, we're going to talk about the amazing bonsai trees and how to grow them. That's tomorrow starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about scary movies to celebrate Halloween. We've got Jeff in Madison, who's got a comment about one of his favorite movies. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi. People haven't talked about this movie in a while. It was 1963, The Haunting, a Shirley Jackson novel made into a movie. And it was made in 63. There weren't many major films shot in black and white then, but this was. And it's one of those movies, it's a very psychological haunted house movie that I've seen so many times. And I think it's just a beautiful movie. I don't know if people are familiar with it.
Okay, thank you, John. You've seen the Haunting, I'm sure, Kelly.
Yeah, The Haunting. It is a great movie. I really like that movie. And then we have more recent things on TV, Netflix. You've got The Haunting of Hill House, and you've got there was a remake of The Haunting at some point. So that notion of people being trapped inside a house and having these archetypes of characters and how these people intersect. Also, the idea of a home where you're supposed to be safe, sort of having these elements that might, you know, possess or change you from within, and, you know, rooted down to deep, deep fears about intimacy and just like safety. You know, problems with safety, and also being around strangers, you know. So that film, if you haven't seen it, I recommend to all our viewers to see that. It is a great film.
And Shirley Jackson certainly came up with some good things for movies, for sure. But she was really good at taking the normal and making it scary.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kimberly near Madison, what comment do you have?
Hi, I'll just talk about scary movies. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Wendigo. And the Wendigo is an entity or a being largely in the North Woods or the North Country of North America. And it possesses, it's a folklore kind of being that possesses human beings. And it uses human beings as a vessel to impose harm and haste and speed and greed. And it takes over human beings. And so you don't necessarily know they're scary or know they're a threat, but they do impose harm and they are very, very vicious. Although they look like your neighbors, your friends, you know, your family. And so it's kind of that get out kind of horror element where human beings are infected, and then they are used to deploy harm because the Wendigo is kind of the spirit that consumes them and corrupts them. And so many nonfiction films, documentaries, horror films, and fictional films have been based on that concept of kind of the human beings as vessels for harm and scariness and horror. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there was a film that's ever used the Wendigo in the film, or as a historian or a cinephile, if you know if that being has ever been used in cinema.
Okay, thanks, Kimberly. Kelly, are you aware of it?
I think there is a movie called The Wendigo.
I think you're right. And I know I've seen TV shows about that, too.
Yeah. I think what's interesting, first of all, to one of your points, is that it is true that one of the biggest deep-seated fears that we have is somehow losing what makes us us, which is like losing your identity or being pushed down, you know, to be in somebody else's control or being trapped inside your body and not being able to communicate. These are all like deep-seated fears that that play with our very notions of being human or being, you know, individuals. And also the other thing is that with the Wendigo and other sorts of folkloric creatures, you have that old style way of living in the world where you are more connected with nature. You're more connected with the mythologies that used to explain the world around us before, say, science came in and, you know, kind of put labels on things. So this is a way of living in the world where the Wendigo can exist. And those fears or, you know, during your dreams, during your sleep, you could, you know, breathe the wrong air and have something invade you. All of those kinds of things have come out in literature, but they also are kind of part of our experience of the world in a way. There are things that happen that we can't explain. You know, we can't explain if we see something out of the corner of our eye, but we know the cat wasn't there or something like that. And so the Wendigo is a way for us to kind of rehearse these really older methods of living in the world, but it also is a deep-seated fear of losing control.
Thank you, Kimberly. Appreciate that. Kelly, there's a lot of horror movies that have been out there. I'm thinking in the, like, maybe the Indominus syndrome, or things about like pandemics and things that could happen in real life. How do you think that affected how people reacted when we went through the latest pandemic?
Well, I think that's a great question, because I think I would say the same is true for horror and science fiction. A role that these play in how we might respond. So when we're watching science fiction, we're watching a hypothetical situation and we're watching how the characters respond to this. We take our cues from them. And in horror, we're kind of watching this rehearsal of our deepest fears. And we know when somebody is, a character is doing something dumb on screen, you know, or we know that they're going to trip, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, but I mean, it is one of those, it's just one of those things that we're always watching for, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure. You know, in the last minute or so that we've got here, what are some of the new horror movies that you're seeing now? How is the genre changing in today's mm-hmm. world?
Well, I think when you say newer, I'm going to go back to 2015 and say The Witch and Get Out were two, and Get Out like later than 2015. Those two films kind of complicate our ideas of how horror can be connected to hereditary sort of like the things that we inherit from generational trauma mm-hmm. or the things we inherit from culture. And I think these, you know, while Get Out is being produced, we have Black Lives Matter movement. We have a lot of other things that are happening where it's a way for us to work out kind of these ideas of the approach to gender and race that are changing, and the ways that we can kind of identify with the characters and their horror, and we can really see how it's connected to history. And I think that's an important part. A final like film that I really like from more recently is called Hellbender. And that film has very little in the way of sort of horror or jump scares. But when you get to the end, it's the kind of contemporary witch story that that connects the idea of witches not to, you know, standing around a fire and chanting, but witches who have a connection to nature and who are trying to kind of battle against their generational inheritance or you know, or its inevitability, I would say. So if you haven't seen Hellbender, I like that one.
Okay. Well, thank you for the recommendation. What are you doing tonight to celebrate Halloween?
I if there's no other haunted prompts to go to, I'll do something.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kelly, so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Kelly Kirshner. She is an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. Thanks to our team for helping to create our shows, Clara Neipert, Joel Pattenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Roberts. I am executive producer Jill Nadeau, and of course, Larry Mueller is our normal host. You have a spooky Halloween.